Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, Oscar-nominated 3:10 to Yuma composer Marco Beltrami, plus world-renowned script consultant and author Linda Sager tells us about her new book and the best screenplay goes to, and filmmaker and actor Jeff Rector tells us about his new film, Revamped. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. This is Movie Geeks United. Did the music just stop?
Yes, it did. It just stopped.
It's prematurely. It's such bad opening music that the player refuses to play it all the way through.
Well, it's 34 music.
It's not stopping. Okay, a little technical difficulties here. This is Movie Geeks United. I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and Jerry is here with us too.
Hey,
Jerry.
I'm here, cracking jokes as usual. How's everyone doing?
Jerry will be manning the chat room. Any listeners, if you want to log on to our chat room, you can submit questions to our guests through that room or just talk about what you're hearing or film in general, any thoughts you might have. Or you can give us a call at 718-508-9477. We have a fantastic show tonight. We love film composers on the show. And we've had a lot of great film composers on. And it's just something I feel so passionate about, film composition.
I think both of us do, and tonight's guest is no exception. I mean, really, he's done a lot of amazing scores.
Yeah, absolutely, and justifiably earning his Academy Award nomination this weekend, which is days away. It's got to be nerve-wracking, but we're going to find out in just a second. I can't wait to talk to him. I just want to let everyone know we're going to be on Oscar night on the 24th. Our show will start at 6 p.m. Eastern as usual on Sunday night. And then we'll be back on Wednesday night as well at 10 p.m. Eastern, where we will welcome director Mark Polanski. His new movie out is called The Penelope. I think it comes out on the 27th, that Friday. It stars Christina Ricci and Reese Witherspoon, James McAvoy. It's a great kind of a great entertaining, heartwarming fable. And then we'll also welcome the filmmakers behind this year's nominee for Best Animated Short, Peter and the Wolf, which I believe, if you remember when Keith Ulick joined us a few weeks ago, he chose that as the winner of that category.
Yeah, and I've been hearing from a couple people they're picking that one.
So we might have an Oscar winner
we
on
might,
our show next.
Yeah.
Man, we're ready.
Yeah, we
are. For something else. Let's get this thing started. As all of our listeners know, the Movie Geeks have a particular love for film composing. We've interviewed some of the best, like Howard Shore and John Ottman and Mark Isham. And our next guest is definitely one of our favorites. Marco Beltrami has given musical life to some of the most exciting films of the past decade, including Scream, Mimic, Hellboy, Terminator 3, Live Free or Die Hard, and the Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. He's been nominated for an Emmy, a Critics' Choice Award, and won 6 ASCAP Awards. And he's just received his first Academy Award nomination for his astounding score to James Mangold's 3:10 to Yuma. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome a brilliant musician and film composer to Movie Geeks United, Mr. Marco Beltrami. Marco, are you with us?
I'm here.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're really excited to speak with you. This has to be a great time for you. You're days away from the Oscars. Are you feeling nervous? What's going on in your mind right now?
The biggest thing for me was that my wife went away with one of our kids, so I was sort of babysitting for 5 days, and that was took precedence over any nervousness from the Oscars, the looming Oscars. But I'm sure, you know, on Sunday I'll have a little pit in my stomach.
Yeah, it would have to be just an exhilarating kind of experience. Did you attend the nominees luncheon?
Oh yeah, that was great. That was a lot of fun. You get to meet everybody, and it's really low key. It was a nice time.
I'm always wondered if there's a certain camaraderie among film composers. If you stay in touch with some of your colleagues and stay on top of what they're doing.
Well, I think as a whole, film composers are pretty much solitary creatures. You know, we pretty much work in dark rooms by ourselves most of the time. And there's a certain level of, I guess, competitiveness or whatever. But I met three of the other candidates there at the luncheon that I hadn't met before: Michael Giacchino, James Newton Howard. Actually, two, yeah, and they were both really nice, and you know, I wish there was more of a spirit of working together and unification among us. And I know they're trying somewhat, like the Society of Composers and Lyricists and all, which is good, but pretty much we're on our own.
Well, and plus you stay so busy too. I mean, you're composing multiple movies every year, and that's got to be a breakneck schedule to fit camaraderie of any sort in. So, did I read some? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was just agreeing with you. Yeah, it is. You know, when it gets busy, it's hard to do anything but just focus on the project that you're working on. But it is nice to hear that from other composers that sort of share the same, you know, and being in the trenches, the same stuff that you do, and have someone that can relate to you. It's nice to meet with other composers.
Yeah, I bet. I read that you were an apprentice to Morricone for 3 years. Is that correct?
No, for some reason there's all kinds of misinformation floating around, but he came over to the United States to get a ASCAP award, a while ago, and I picked him up at the airport and took him around for, over a couple days, but I never studied with him at all.
Okay, I think it was an interview I saw with Tommy Lee Jones, I think I must have been mistaken, where he was discussing that, but
there's an interview that I'm making with, that I did with Tommy Lee Jones, and he wasn't really a fan of Morricone's, at least for in reference to his movie that we were working on, the Three Burials, Melquiades,
yeah.
Estrada, and he always seemed to hear like little Morricone references, and so he said something in an interview that is probably the thing that you saw where he sort of makes fun that, you know, and he says, and you studied with Morricone for whatever, but he was doing that mainly as a dig at me.
That was an inside joke, okay.
Yeah.
But was Goldsmith one of your teachers? Is that correct?
Yeah, Goldsmith was. Yeah, Jerry was.
Okay.
He was great. Yeah, when I came to California, there was a program at USC, and he was mentoring it that year, and so it was great. I had the opportunity to study with him for a year.
Now, did you know that you wanted to focus on film composition at that time? I know you're a musician. I'm wondering how that decision comes about from being a musician to focusing on film composition.
Well, it was for me. It was really a matter of practicality. I mean, I got a master's degree from Yale School of Music, and then I was thinking, what do I want to do? I either teach or you do something commercial. And teaching for me, I just felt like, to just go through the system and then so that you can be spit out and teach, it seems kind of crazy. Like, what do you have to say, you know?
Right.
So I knew I wanted to do something commercial, but I really knew very little about film scoring. And I applied. I heard about this program out at USC, and I applied to it and was fortunate to get accepted. And then I decided to come out here. And that's really when I learned about film scoring. I knew nothing about it. I had a job working for Chris Young as like a coffee boy for him for a little while, and then I ended up doing some orchestration for him and various tasks, and from there I started getting some stuff on my own.
Mm. Well, I know that I read an interview with you taken several years back, and the question was, is there something that you're yearning to do, some kind of project? And you said, I would love to do a Western.
Right.
So I would imagine 310 to Yuma falling on your lap. How'd have been a dream come true?
It was great. I mean, when I heard about Jim making this movie, I heard about it long before I was hired. And, I was I had no idea what their choice was for music, but I had met him before, and I had known Kathy, his wife, Kathy Conrad, since she was one of the producers on the Scream movies that I had worked on. And
yeah.
So I wrote her a letter and mentioned how much I'd want to work on it. And, you know, it turned out they had a lot of attempt with music that I had written for Tommy Lee Jones's movie. And it just sort of worked out, and I was really happy because, you know, I'm a huge fan of the old spaghetti western scores, and you know, it was just a great opportunity to do like sort of cool homage to it.
Yeah, and at the same time, and your Three Burial scores, just like this as well, it's familiar. You know that you're dealing with western themes here. It sounds familiar, but there's something so unique and different about it at the same time. It's kind of a real different bent to it. And coming from someone like me that doesn't think musically, what is that different spin you put on the western theme there with 310?
Well, I don't know. I think the thing is, the thing I like about Morricone is not, you know, it's not a question of, you know, pastiching something he did or just copying his style or something. What I like about what he did is how he would approach music. He would take all these diverse sounds that aren't necessarily orchestral, but he would combine them together and then use them in a novel way, you know, whether it's a clock ticking or, you know, reverb banging on an amp or whatever it happens to
right.
be, or someone whistling and make this sort of patchwork of things. And that's sort of how I approached 310 to Yuma. And that's where I think there's similarity in approach. And then, you know, in terms of the specifics, it was, you know, every instrument that I used in 310 to Yuma was something that could have been around in the period of the movie.
Mm.
They were all, you know, from the tack piano to the pump organ they were all things that were around in the 19th century. And then it was just my thing compositionally was to try to make it, to modernize it, you know, with the help of the guy I work with, Buck Sanders. We've been working together for about 10 years. And he's really good with the computer stuff. We manipulated all the sounds and made it more modern.
It's a beautiful, I mean, it's gorgeous work. But in terms of how early in the process do you like to be involved? Are you generally brought on from the beginning or towards the end?
It's different. On this, I was brought in sort of towards the end where they almost had a complete locked picture. And I had about 6 weeks. I could have used a little bit more time for it, but that's about average, I guess, 6 to 8 weeks. For a project. Sometimes I get brought on earlier, but if it's too early, you can sort of get sidetracked because you don't want to work from a script or even an incomplete picture because it's easy to get thrown off on a tangent. And,
yeah.
And you know, it's so important, especially in a movie like this. I mean, just every nuance of the actors and, like, you know, Russell Crowe just looking at the hawk in the tree, the way...
Mm-hmm.
He perceives it as really essential to how you score the scene. So you need to see that there.
So what kind of presence was Mangold? Was he an ideal director to work with in the studio?
He has a great enthusiasm for the whole process, and that makes it really exciting to work for him because he'll be open to whatever you're doing. You know, it's not like he has a preconceived notion of the score has to sound like this or whatever. He's open to a lot of experimentation, and that's that makes it the job really interesting.
Do the best directors tend to speak in terms of the feeling that they're trying to capture in a certain moment more so than the details of this instrument, that instrument?
Most directors don't have extensive musical knowledge. Some have some, but you know, it's an abstract language, so they talk in terms of the scene and emotionally what it's trying to do and all, and it's up to the composer to sort of translate that and engage that in musical terms. But
yeah,
it can be, you know, it depending on you have directors that some directors don't really, that's a hard thing, if they don't really know what it is, what they're trying to achieve musically or in the scene, and so they're not sure when they hear it, you know. That can be hard, but that wasn't the case on this project.
Yeah, I hear about it. I hear with the other composers that we interview, it's they say that, you know, they much prefer a director to speak in terms of how they want a certain scene to feel than give them the directions on, you know,
yeah,
this
you don't
needs
want
to come in
to
here.
Say,
yeah,
you know, I had a producer, and the director was fired, and then the producer came to the scoring, and you know, he had his girlfriend there, and she kept saying, "I don't like the Tiffany." You know, for the for the kettle drums are called, you know, the timpani. She was calling them the Tiffany, and so you know, you can get that, and then it's like, how do you deal with that? That's
a nightmare.
A nightmare.
So tell me about your upcoming projects. You have several movies on the horizon, don't you?
Right now, I'm working on a movie called The Hurt Locker, it's actually it's sort of like an Iraq war picture.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Catherine Bigelow is directing, and it's a really good character piece about these guys that dismantle the roadside bombs. It's something I'm just starting on now. I had another picture that I thought was already going to be scored by now, but it's been in delay for a while. I think there's some troubles with the production, amongst the production, but it's a movie for Bertrand Tavernier, who's a
wow.
He's a wonderful director.
Yeah. And it's a great piece for music too, because it's all set in, well, it's based on a James Lee Burke novel.
It's a great book.
Have you read
the
book?
Very good book.
Yeah. So, you know, it all takes place in sort of this backwater Louisiana.
They're a great series of books, yeah.
Yeah, so it's music, you know, for a composer, it's like a dream to work on a project where you can really go and, you know, I spent, this one I came on early, right when before they even started shooting, and so I spent the better part of a year just going down to Louisiana, to the university there, Lafayette, and meeting musicians and working with them and really getting immersed in Cajun music. And so the score has a lot of Cajun influence to it.
Cool.
So I'm just
hoping
that we get to record it sometime soon, because it's all the music's pretty much written.
And talk about a filmmaker that has tremendous respect for music in his films.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, that's an example of someone that does have some musical knowledge and can actually talk about instruments and all, but yet still has a tremendous respect for the composer and would never say, you know, like a comment like that before. But
right.
But yeah, I mean, he's a tremendous figure.
Wow. And I know you've been asked this ad nauseum, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Have you been approached yet about Terminator 4?
They mentioned it at I had a meeting recently at Warner Brothers, and they mentioned it. And I'm up for it. I think they might. They also mentioned that they might want to take a different direction with it. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. I mean, if it happened, it could be a fun project. I really don't know.
I
don't know anything. But
with action and horror, is there? Do you feel like you're able to kind of let loose as a musician in those genres, or are they just the same as any other?
I've done so much, it comes easily. Like, I know I can sort of rely on tricks that I know will work really easily. So it, in a way, it doesn't take as much effort, you know. But
right.
I don't know if that's good or not. You know, it's sort of hard to push myself to do. To reinvent things, but you know, having said that, it sort of comes very easily. You know, 20th century music techniques, stuff that I was trained in, just lend themselves really well to horror scores. So you know, I don't know, but I definitely have ideas about you know, doing other types of stuff as well.
Well, I know that you years ago you said that you want to work in the Western genre, and that, now that you've done that, is there something else that you want to do, another kind of dream project?
Well, I still think it'd be fun to do like a more of a like a big epic type of orchestral Western, because that's you know, this was more of like a stylized thing, but I have ideas for that too. You know, I think it's not really dependent so much on the genre of the picture as the picture itself and the quality of it and what you get from it, and whatever field it happens to be in, you know, I think that's what's important.
Do composers, I guess you can only speak for yourself, but this is the last question, we'll let you go, but do you look at some directors and want to work with them? Are there some directors that you see that are very strong in terms of where you would like to lend your composing skills to their work?
I think actually someone whose work I like a lot, I went to school with, but I didn't know him there. We both went to Brown University. This guy, Doug Liman, I think he's a good director. And I like his approach to stuff. I guess a lot of directors, when I see the movies, if I am attracted to their work, then I'll want to work with them. But I don't know.
The list is too long.
Yeah, too long. And yeah, exactly.
Well, we are crazy about you on this show, and it's a beautiful score for 3:10 to Yuma, and believe me, we are going to be cheering you on Sunday night.
Good luck.
And thank you so much for joining us tonight on the show.
Thank you.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I'm sorry about the other week.
Oh no, that's fine. We got you tonight. We couldn't be happier.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank
very
you,
much.
Marco.
All right.
Bye bye now. That is Marco Beltrami, composer of 3:10 to Yuma. He's a very very busy guy, as you can expect.
Yeah, he is.
You know, the nonstop press that comes with being Oscar nominated, and then you got the scores that you're working on currently. You know, it doesn't mean you stop working. It's not a vacation.
No, he's always saying he's been very busy in a short amount of time. His output is remarkable. It's just tremendous.
It is astounding, the output of some of these composers. I mean, many that we've spoken to, where they have, how do you have 7 projects in 1 year?
Yeah,
I mean,
unbelievable.
Astounding stuff.
Yeah.
Very, very productive artist. And that's a great honor to have spoken to him tonight, and we will be cheering him on.
Yes.
So, Jerry, how have you been while we wait a few minutes for our next guest to pop up?
I've been all right, you know, just chilling out, really just work and that kind of stuff. Nothing big to report since Sunday night. You know, how about you?
I've seen some good movies.
You saw this gentleman's movie that Binge You 3:10 to Yuma.
Yeah, I got around to watching it. I listened to the score actually, separate, independent of the film. And listening to the score, I was thinking, man, it's amazing music. And I was
man,
I wonder how this plays with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Plays perfectly.
Of course.
Of course it does. I mean, that's a no brainer. But
yeah.
But it just brings so much like life to the movie that maybe would not have been there otherwise. I mean, it elevates it.
Yeah, it did. It is a really good movie.
I was very impressed with the movie, and I saw another film that I was very impressed with, and that is We Own the Night.
That's a great one.
Yeah, and
both
of
them are really good.
And I understand how We Own the Night is an example of kind of a standard. And 3:10 to Yuma is too, a standard kind of standard genre film. You know, you essentially know what you're getting with the film. It's the nuances of the characters and the portrayals of the actors that elevate the material, and the strength of the writing. I mean, the details of the writing.
Yes,
but really, both movies are an opportunity to just see some actors shine.
Actors shine and just really. Like, I really liked both of them, and I like 310 to Yuma, and I like, you know, I watched the original one the night before we saw the remake, and I have to say that they're both work on their own. I mean, you couldn't directly remake the one with Glenn Ford for today, because I think people...
Yeah, the original was Glenn Ford, right?
Yeah.
What role did he play? He played the...
he plays Russell Crowe.
Okay.
And he plays Russell Crowe character, and I forget, I think, I want to say Van Heflin is the Christian Bale, but don't quote me on that. But there are some, it's really funny, the scene where they have the dinner sequence with the whole family, I could swear to you is like the exact same thing. I thought that was neat that they decided not to change that at all. But there's some things you have to change. You couldn't end the movie today like you ended it back then. People would have just been, I mean, I just don't see how you could have done that. So I thought the ending of this one was perfect.
See, I don't know how the original ended. I love the conclusion of this one. And it's so odd. The turn that it takes is so human. But when you look at what's actually happening and you think about it, you're thinking, man, this is almost ridiculous in a way. But it feels so... part of that, the fabric of that movie and the direction it took between during that relationship, where there's a tremendous amount of respect and honor that Russell Crowe has for the Christian Bale character.
Oh yes.
That really becomes so much of the heart of that movie.
It does, and who's really good in that, and is Ben Foster in that movie as Russell Crowe's. I guess you would say his second in command.
It's a very good, colorful supporting role.
He had a very good year last year, but he was great in that.
Yeah, and you think of the supporting roles that tend to get nominated, and they're usually the colorful variety.
Yeah,
and he definitely fits that bill, even though he wasn't nominated this year.
But there's a lot of good stuff every year if you really think about it. You know, there's a book that just came out. Guy by the name of Mark Harris, I think, wrote about this, either the 67 or 68, the five best picture nominees.
We're working on booking him on the show, yeah.
And it's interesting. He wrote an op-ed piece, I want to say, for the Times, New York Times. But he said, you know, really the best movies, the movies that you tend to remember are the ones that didn't get nominated each year. And it's really interesting.
Well, there are a slew of them. But,
yeah,
but
I mean,
Mark Harris is covering. Mark Harris is covering the 67 Oscars.
Yeah.
Which was Who's Coming to Dinner and Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
A seminal year for the Oscars. A lot of envelope-pushing films that challenged the culture of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important subject. I can't wait to read that book. And actually, we're working on trying to book him. Because there's a special edition Bonnie and Clyde out the end of next month, I believe.
Oh, that's cool. That's a great movie. I love that. We rob banks. That's a great line. I love it. We rob banks.
Yeah, it's a terrific movie. Our next guest is up and ready to go, I believe. So,
right.
So are you all set?
I'm all set.
All right, let's do it. Dr. Linda Sager is here. She is one of the most renowned script consultants working today. Aside from lending her expert insights on thousands of movie scripts, she is also an acclaimed teacher and lecturer and author, whose series of books include classic and inspiring works like Making a Good Script Great and Creating Unforgettable Characters. Her new book, And the Best Screenplay Goes To, offers a thorough and exhilarating breakdown of three Oscar-winning screenplays, Sideways, Shakespeare in Love, and Crash. As she goes through the scripts beat by beat and interviews the writers involved in each project, your appreciation for these films only grow more profound. This invaluable book clearly comes from a scholar who has spent years living and breathing these films, but it ultimately succeeds because it speaks to the qualities that draw us back to great cinema. That is, a film's capacity to inspire the soul and provoke the mind. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Linda Sager to our program. Linda, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. I loved your book. I ate it up.
Oh, good. I ate them up while I wrote that. I just loved working on those three scripts and interviewing the writers and just having a lot of great things to think about.
Oh, that must have been a dream. But I wanted to start by asking you how you made your journey into this industry and how you fell into script consulting.
Well, I started out in theater, and I used to teach college theater, and I used to direct theater, so I had a lot of personal, practical experience. And then when I lost one of my jobs teaching theater at a time when everything was being cut back, I was on the outskirts of L.A., and I thought, well, it's obvious that I should move into the film industry, thinking that they'd really want me. And, of course, they couldn't have cared less. So I did a lot of different kind of jobs for a couple years, and I realized that my skill really was with scripts, because I had a master's in drama, I had done this, and then I had a doctorate in this strange degree of drama and theology, but I had done my dissertation on what makes a script work, and I had developed this method of how to break down a script and understand why it works or why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And after realizing that it was not real easy to break into this industry, and this was my second career. I'd been a university professor in drama. I just decided to start my own business. And I started this business. I came up with the term script consultant with the help of my hairdresser.
Wow, because this was 1981.
I was describing to my hairdresser this new business I was going to start, and he says, well, what are you going to call yourself? And I said, I don't really know. And he says, well, what will you be doing? And I said, I'll be consulting on scripts. And he said, well, then you're a script consultant. I said,
got
sense.
It. There you go.
I went to a career consultant, and I said, I have this idea for a business. I had been doing it just really a small way, and I said, I want this to be my full-time business. How do you get a business going that has never existed before? No one has ever paid for it. They don't know who you are. They couldn't care less. And I'm asking people to, you know, pay me money for this. And she said, well, there's a way to do this. And I worked with her. Her name was Judith Clare. She lives in Santa Monica. So I worked with Judith for about 5 months, and it worked. I mean, that's just how brilliant she was. She said, this is how you start a business. And, of course, then it started to grow, and I did seminars, and then I eventually started writing the book. So it's been 27 years now.
Plus, you know, obviously there's an art involved in screenwriting. And I know you've said in your book, too, that you see that people have the craft of screenwriting down, but they're missing the art of it.
Or sometimes they have the art down and they're missing the craft of it.
But I would think that would be a booming business because, you know, everyone thinks that they at least have one screenplay in them.
Yes, and I do get clients from all over the world. I got my first client from Turkey this year. Gotten them from South America. I've had two scripts I've worked on from Russia, which I actually think might have filmed. Of course, you know, it's very difficult to know what's going on over there when you work on a script and 2 years later someone says, oh, I saw the film you worked on.
Yeah.
So a lot of interesting places. I've worked on a script from Hong Kong and, you know, just all six continents. And then in terms of my seminars, I've now been to 30 countries and six continents. I was waiting for South America for a long time and finally went there last year.
This is something that I want to ask you about because we've had some other screenwriters and consultants on the show prior, and I'm wondering how is there a different story sensibility outside of America?
Yes, there is. And sometimes writers outside of America are very subtle. I'm working on a script right now from Great Britain, and it is so subtle you hardly know what's going on. So I'm pulling out the threads, and I'm talking. I'm actually using musical metaphors in my report and saying it's like we don't quite have a melody and we don't quite have harmonies, and I can sense that it's under the surface, but now we have to bring it out and make this piece of music really work. And so I'm being very specific with the details. But yeah, and a lot of times writers from other countries have not had a strong sense of structure. I think Americans have had a better sense of that.
Yeah.
And yet they have been quite open to learning about it, and they have many times been much better at character and theme than we have. I think a lot of other countries are much more philosophical. They think about meanings and, you know, in different ways. So we can learn that from them, and they can learn more about how to structure and shape a story from us.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I understand. But there are a lot of screenplay books out there, and you've obviously contributed some great volumes on the subject. But what void does this new book fill, and the screenplay goes to? What inspired you to write it?
Well, it's interesting because when I wrote my first book was Making a Good Script Read, and that came out the very end of 1987, and there had only been about 5 or 6 books on screenwriting from the time of Sid Field's 2 books, which started in 1978,
yeah.
I think 1980. And then after mine came out, there were just a slew of them, and there's hundreds now.
Oh, yeah.
But I got this idea partly out of what, you remember the Cliff Notes in college? Cliff Notes were these small brochures, or, you know, they were maybe 40 pages.
Don't they still have them?
I
don't know if they still have them out there, but they were on novels.
In high school and college, I kept that company going, believe me.
I think everyone did.
So you said, well, I don't really need to read Tom Jones because I have the Cliff Notes on
sure.
Tom Jones. And you know, and they did a synopsis, and they analyzed it, and, you know, they gave you some insights into it. And, of course, they were used in a lot of universities and colleges and a lot of, you know, college students. So I wondered about having the Sager Notes on Academy Award-winning movies. And my original idea was that I would just start doing these Academy Award-winning scripts and do these, like, 40 or 50 pages. Well, I went to my previous publishers and pitched this idea, and they said, we just don't see a market. It's just too hard to sell these little brochure kind of, you know, 40, 50 pages.
Huh.
And so nobody was very interested. And so I just thought, well, okay, that was a thought. And then Michael Wisey Publications, which I knew these people, but I'd never done a book with them.
They're fantastic, yeah.
You know, they had said to me at various times over the year, it would be nice to work with you at some point. And so when I sent it to them, they said, you know what, if you could take 3 and put them in one book, we would be interested. Are you willing to do that? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, now, are your other publishers going to want this? And I said, no, they already turned me down. I said, if you want it, get it. And so, and then what happened was I started writing this, and I actually kind of inserted another book in this whole process, which they let me do. So, but then I came back to this one. And the thing was finding the 3 scripts and trying to decide which it would be was not real easy, because part of what we decided we would do was to interview the writers
mm-hmm.
and the directors. Well, that meant that not only did the script have to have won an Academy Award, but the writer and directors had to be willing to talk to me. And a lot of times after they've done all those interviews, and it's 2 or 3 or 4 years later, they don't want to talk about it anymore.
They're on to the next baby, yeah.
Yeah, and so there was a point I was having some trouble, but I found if I waited long enough, the Academy Awards would come. So during, because this process went on for a few years, well, meanwhile, Sideways and then Crash won. And I said, oh, those would be really good. So
yeah.
I really finished the book after Crash had won and after those writers were willing to talk to me.
What I really liked is the initial question that you were posing from each screenplay. You know, there's a central question you wanted to explore. Like Shakespeare in Love, you wanted to know, how do you manage to make a period piece contemporary? And what were the questions for
well,
Sideways and Crash?
Sideways was, how do you do a simple script like a road movie and make it interesting? Mm. And then Crash was, how do you do an ensemble piece that is very, very complex in terms of a structure that is actually a very thematic work? And how do you explore a theme like racism very deeply?
Right.
So, and that was another thing in looking at scripts, because there were some that had won Academy Awards, and I thought, I just don't want to spend the next year of my life with these scripts. They're not that interesting to me. So I, as I looked, it wasn't as if I had 20 scripts I was seriously thinking of doing. I said, some of those that have won Academy Awards are not of great interest to me, and I'm not sure what I would do with them, because I don't think they're unusual enough or they have challenges that I think are really worth exploring. You know, how could I write 70 pages? So when I did come up with these three, and then when the writers and directors agreed to talk to me, I was very happy with the choice and really enjoyed working on all three of them.
Well, the one that I'd like to focus on, because it's just for selfish purposes, it's my favorite of the three, is Sideways. And this is a journey film, and Alexander Payne has made, you know, you could say that about Schmidt is a journey film as well,
yeah.
I imagine. What drew you to Sideways in particular when you first came upon it?
Well, when I first saw the movie, I found a lot of charm and humor about this whole thing about wine, because I enjoy a glass of wine, but I had not, I don't know if I'd ever had Pinot Noir or not, and then I had been in that area, in that Santa Ynez Valley, but had not really explored it very much. I thought it was so simple, and yet it was so interesting because of the characters and the journeys and even kind of these potential transformations and a lot of insider jokes about wine. And then, of course, when I started working on it, it was a fun movie to work with. I went to the Santa Ynez Valley, and I did the wine tour, and naturally, I went with a good friend of mine who's also in the film industry, whose name is Mara Pearl, who's also a novelist, and Mara was the designated driver because she doesn't drink much. It wasn't like I was drinking all that much. But
honest, it was just an excuse to drink wine.
I had to, of course, taste the wines at all the wineries that were in the movie, and I had to experience Pinot. And I had done an interview with Rex Pickett, who wrote the novel, right before I went on this journey. And he said, now, the first thing you do when you get up there is you have to see, I think his name is Jim Burroughs. He was one of the people in the movie, but he's actually somebody who is at one of the wineries, and he shows you how to taste, and he says, you go and you see him, and you tell him Rex sent you, and ask him to go through how you taste wine. And, of course, he showed me the swirling and the sniffing and the color and the oxygenation, and that was my first stop is to figure out how you're supposed to do this correctly. And I think we did, I think there's actually seven wineries in there. So we went to all seven over a period of
time. Oh, I'm game for that.
Of course.
And
probably one of my favorite was the Fess Parker one, having grown up a bit with Davy Crockett. And that was the one where he overturns the spit bucket. And they said a lot of tourists come in and they want to do exactly what Miles had done. And they said they get really tired of the tourists, but it was fascinating to kind of enter in the world and to see how a movie takes a location and, in a sense, a prop like wine, brings a whole new way of looking at it.
Well, and like all great movies, you're constantly discovering new things within it. And I'm not the brightest bulb in the shed, but watching it, I just tend to let a movie happen to me the first time I watch it. But reading your book, there was a segment where you say Sideways also found an audience by introducing us to the world of wine, how to swirl it, smell it, taste it, and perhaps even drink too much of it. And it struck me that could wine in the film be symbolic as to how these characters experience life?
Yes, and both the wine is, and then the title of Sideways is that they are going sideways toward life. Maya's the only one that's found herself, and at one point she hadn't. But she had been going sideways, and then before the film starts, she's kind of worked out her life a lot. But everybody else in the movie, your main characters, are going sideways. Mm-hmm. They're like a crab, not quite going directly at things.
Right.
And at the end, you get a sense that Miles is starting to be more direct. Probably Stephanie won't be, and probably Jack won't be. And one of the wonderful things going on a tour like this with somebody who, you know, has been in film and worked in film, Mar and I were driving down one of these beautiful, beautiful country roads past all these vineyards, and we had the tape recorder on, and I said, okay, let's brainstorm everything that that title means. And, of course, you come up with a lot more ideas when you're talking to somebody like that than, you know, probably on your own. But we just had this. We must have talked for half hour just on that title, and a lot of that found its way into the, you know, into the book.
Something that strikes me about the script, and it's similar to my feelings of Juno, which is up for a screenplay award this year.
And they are similar in some ways. Very simple stories done extremely well.
Yeah, they're familiar. These characters are familiar, but you haven't necessarily seen them before. You know, and like the out of work TV actor character in Sideways, he could have just as well been written as a caricature.
Yes, and he was really quite real.
He was. Oh, he was great. I mean.
Yeah, and it's that ability to we spoke to Bo Goldman on last Sunday's show, and we started to talk about theme, and he kind of threw aside the notion of theme. He said, you just write what is, and I think what he was speaking to was if you're so concerned with theme, there's the danger of being too on the nose with it, and that's something that strikes me about both Sideways and Juno, is there anything but on the nose?
Yeah, and see, I think he's saying you can get to be a message and then you forget the story and the characters. But that's also a difference because he's a writer and I'm a consultant. So his job is to know what has to stay unconscious and what has to be conscious. My job is to make everything conscious.
Right.
And to, you know, when I consult and... So I do a lot of work with theme, but I always make sure it integrates with story and with character.
Tell me how story is different from plot. I know it sounds like a simple question, but it's an important difference, isn't it?
Well, I think some people think it is, and it may be. It's not something that I spend much time thinking about. I tend to think more in terms of what is the story, what is this unfolding of events that has a beginning, middle, and end, what is the shape of the story, what's the structure of the story, and how does this develop, and what sort of intrinsically belongs in Act 1, which is the setup, Act 2, which is the development, and Act 3, which is the payoff. And so I don't do much right. I don't think in any of my books I've really written about let's break down plot versus let's break down story. I think sometimes when people talk about that, they say maybe plot or the specific events. But I don't know. You know, it's mm-hmm. one of those discussions some people have and other people say it doesn't matter to me a real lot. I think if I were a university professor, I would have to spend a lot of time deciding that because I would have to teach it as a consultant and say, I just want the story to work, so I'm going to deal, you know, more with what does that mean to set up a story? What does it mean to get the story to unfold? And what does it mean to pay it off? And so I don't talk much about the word plot. I talk about the word story as the unfolding of events. And I think that's what, you know, sometimes people think of us who write books or do screenwriting and, you know, we're the big gurus and they decide which guru they're going to follow. And I say, you know, you better follow all of us, not one of us, because we all focus on different things.
Yeah.
And I know most of my colleagues who are doing seminars and writing books, and I've endorsed many of their books, and they endorse mine. But one of the things, you know, I find is that we're very complementary, but we focus on different things. Many people have said, for instance, I focus a lot more on subplot and on theme. And on images. I've been increasingly in my last few books been working a lot more with the whole idea of what are the images, how do they work, are they cinematic, are they part of image systems that work throughout the whole movie. And other people, I think, you know, they focus on different things. I know people who focus on the idea of what is the situation and how is and then what is the plot, and then what is the story, and how are all those things different? And
yeah,
you know, and I say, great, but I'm looking at different things.
Well, very quickly, I just want to make mention of Crash, because obviously it's an Oscar winner. It's an Oscar winner for Best Picture as well. You know, it's received some backlash since its win, but reading your beat by beat breakdown of the film, it gave me a real new appreciation for the picture. And this movie means a lot to you, doesn't it?
Well, I thought it was just a beautiful exploration of the racism theme, and you know, what it and the way that it approached that theme, plus incredible structure. It had had 14 stories that had to be structured and to interweave and to keep connecting and having these collisions all the way through. And what fascinated me was that there have been films that have tried to do this. Traffic, Syriana, Babel were probably the three main ones, but none of them succeeded from a purely craft and artistic viewpoint, in my opinion, as well as Crash did. And I thought a lot about why did I feel this one succeeded and the other ones did not succeed as well. I'm not saying they weren't good. I just didn't feel that they succeeded as well. And I realized it was because the intersections took longer to happen in movies like Traffic, Syriana, and Babel, and that they were less clear, and that they were sometimes less clear about what we were really exploring here. Whereas in Crash, every story echoed and resonated with the idea and yet remained as a story that had beginning, middle, and ends, and surprises and turning points. And I think also because of my theology background, we could say theology, philosophical background, I'm really interested in meaning. I'm interested in themes and then saying, what is this movie really about?
Yeah.
And saying, what can I learn from it? Do I become a better person from having watched Crash and looked at that and looked at the way we do stereotype and the way stereotypes break down and how these writers explored these? And I mean, just such interesting ways of, and I love that the title of Crash, because the first words in that movie are about we don't, you know, in L.A., we don't touch each other. Well,
yeah.
If you don't touch each other, you also don't break stereotypes. And so you have to get close to people, and you have to touch them on one level or another in order to break the stereotype and realize what has to be crashed, where are the collisions that have to happen to, you know, move through that.
You offer just a beautiful examination of that movie, and it's a beautiful book. And anyone that appreciates movies in any way, whether you're right or not, you have a lot to gain from this book. Before I let you go, it is Oscar time.
Yes.
And I wanted to get your thoughts on this year's nominees for the Screenplay Awards. We spoke about Juno.
Here's what I think is going to happen. I think that Juno is going to win for Best Original Screenplay. And what is so amazing this year is that 4 out of those 5 are done by women.
Right.
Best Original Screenplay, Juno, Lars and the Real Girl, Ratatouille, and The Savages all have women writers. This has never happened. I mean, I've been waiting to see this for
first person to mention that. It's a big deal.
Yeah, and I think that because Diablo Cody won for Juno for the Writers Guild Award, this is a very natural win. And I remember when I saw it, I said, this script has got to be nominated, and I wouldn't be surprised if it won. The other reason, sometimes there's very subtle reasons why something wins. I mean, I really think Juno deserves it, but
there's
an awful lot of other good things here, too. But I think sometimes when somebody is looking and saying, okay, I got 5 really interesting things, what do I want to win? There's a little bit of somebody that says, I really want to see Diablo Cody go up there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, her background is a stripper. And,
mm-hmm.
and there's a little part in my mind that says, I want to know what she's going to wear. I want to see her.
I agree with you. But Juno it's crafted by a writer that has such a unique voice.
Oh, it was a beautiful voice. It was just a fabulous voice. Yeah.
And nothing is more rare than to find a writer with their own voice. I think that would have to be the greatest challenge for a writer.
And you know what I love about it? She's only 29, and I think this is a person that can have a really, really good career. And
yeah.
Then I look at things like Savages, nominee was Tamara Jenkins, wrote and directed it. And Ratatouille was co-directed by Jan Pinkava, woman. So the thing that excites me about this, we've waited so long to get women and writers and directors, and they've just been so underappreciated. I am hoping that this is not just a this year thing. But the other nice thing, under Best Adapted Screenplay, we have a woman there, too. And, you know, if we think historically, is that Kelly Curry won for Thelma and Louise and Jane Campion won for The Piano. But you start thinking in the last 20 or 30 years, you got to think really hard past that. I mean,
right.
It's really been different. Now, I think what's going to happen at Adapted is that No Country for Old Men, it's won Writers Guild. And and if that wins for Adapted, then we can, because he won, the guy, Coen Brothers, won the Directors Guild Award, we can sort of expect that they'll probably win the Directors Guild, the Director Award, and then that usually leads to the Best Picture.
Most of the time it
award.
Does. Yeah.
Yeah, and usually what's going to happen, and you start knowing how things are going to go, is you see what wins for Best Original, let's say Juno won, and then you say Best Adapted, if No Country for Old Men, you say probably one of those two are going to win for Best
yeah.
Picture. And generally, a movie like Juno, which is kind of a smaller movie, it's like Sideways, generally does not win for Best Picture. You notice Sideways did not win Best Picture, but it won Best Adapted Screenplay.
Right.
So I think we're going to, I have a feeling in those categories that's what we're going to see.
I agree with you completely on the screenplay. I've gone out on a limb here, and I've said that Juno will pick up Best Picture. I have a feeling that last year it was Little Miss Sunshine was getting a lot of buzz, but it didn't quite make it. I think this is an even more beloved film, and I think they're going to go with Juno instead of the darker subject matter. I'm hoping it would be great.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be disappointed at all if that happened. And it's been interesting that Atonement, which has been winning some of the earlier awards in terms of, I think Atonement won the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
But Atonement doesn't seem to be coming up to the surface with other awards now. And I think what has been happening is that the Coen brothers, there's been a lot of buzz around them and No Country for Old Men. And sometimes what happens is when somebody wins, it isn't just for that picture. Like if No Country for Old Men wins, it isn't just No Country for Old Men.
It's for that body of work from the Coens.
It's that
yeah.
whole body of work of the Coen brothers.
That's true.
And sometimes what happens is someone says it's their year. And,
right.
You know, they didn't
but you know, I think that that's probably true. But this is as good as they've ever been. So it, you know, it's not like one of those lifetime achievements given as a regular award. Because I mean, they're as strong as they've ever been as filmmakers with this new film.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's
everything is sort of leading toward No Country for Old Men. I'm not saying it might not go that way, but because a couple of years ago everything was going toward Brokeback Mountain and then
yeah,
Crash
yeah.
On. So we, you know, we can see that. And then I think the acting categories are going to go in, you know, different directions. Although I do think for supporting the person in No Country for Old Men,
he hasn't locked up, I
think. Probably because he's been winning all this other stuff, the SAG Awards and Golden Globes and all that. He'd probably win Best Supporting Actor. And I think that Julie Christie has the edge on Best Actress because she's been winning a whole lot of
right.
other awards. And Daniel Day-Lewis keeps picking up all the other awards like the SAG and all that. And I think the Best Supporting Actress is going to be the category that is going to be maybe the hardest.
Mm-hmm.
That category haunts me this year. Yeah, it's tough.
I think if the SAG Award was given to Ruby Dee for American Gangster and Cate Blanchett got the Golden Globes, which is not as close an indicator. But what's interesting is Cate Blanchett is up for Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress. when that has happened before, generally the person is one for supporting actress. Jessica Lange did that. She was up for Tootsie for supporting, and she was up for that. Was it Frances Farmer?
I think it was
Blue Sky.
That really strange psychological one for Best Actress, and she won for Best Supporting, and I think this has happened a few other times.
Pacino, I think it happened to Pacino with Glengarry and Sense of a Woman.
Sense of a Woman, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now, I do think, though, that Ruby Dee in American Gangster, the fact that it's SAG, and, you know, there's something about, we've had such great black actors this year, and some great, what I would call black movies. I mean, I love The Great Debaters, movies about African Americans, and they're, again, just like women have been underappreciated, the black have also. And there is a lot of times that the Academy will make a statement. Again, if all things being equal, you say, what's my better statement to make? And I would tend to look at this, and I would say, you want to make a statement, you give it to Ruby Dee. Not that she's not deserving of it, because she absolutely is, but you get to make a bigger statement. And actually, you get to make a statement politically, which, of course, the Academy loves to do anyway.
Yes, they do.
Because you got a lot of Obama lovers out
well,
there.
Well, you know, and that's something, because you're mentioning more opportunities for women in the writing field this year, and our elections this year, I mean, we're a pretty diverse country this year, aren't we?
Yes, yeah, and you're seeing some of it in what's happening with the Academy Awards. So
yeah.
I mean, if I had to choose, I'd probably say, if I really have to sit down and, you know, decide what I'm going to write down that night, I would probably say Ruby Dee. But
okay, we're going to hold you to it. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. You have a wonderful book. Where can they purchase it? Obviously, in bookstores.
Probably in a lot of bookstores, but certainly Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And if they would like it and want to write a review, all the better.
Okay.
The book is called And the Best Screenplay Goes to Linda Sager. Thank you so much, ma'am, for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. A great book. Great conversation. Well, we should have had her on our Oscar show.
Yeah, really.
She had some definite opinions there.
Yeah.
I tell you, my opinion on Best Supporting Actress changes every day.
I would like to see, actually, of all of them, I have to say, I wouldn't mind seeing Amy Ryan get it.
That's who I've been sticking with, just because I'm trying to be stubborn about the category. But then you throw Tilda Swinton in there.
Tilda Swinton, and I also think you'd be giving it to Tilda Swinton, you know, talk about a body of work, because I've always think for some past performances she's been snubbed just in nomination wise. Like,
and then you have Cate Blanchett, and you know, talk about a body of work.
Yeah, she has a body, but she already got it for The Aviator, and she shouldn't even be nominated for Elizabeth this one.
Oh no, I'm talking about I'm Not There. I'm Not.
I'm Not There. She's great, but
supporting is just tough.
The supporting's tough, and it's you know, well, let's get that out of the way early, so the anticipation will be over.
Yeah, and that'll be the first X I get on my ballot, because I have a contest every year, and it's so embarrassing. I'm supposed to be the movie guy, but year after year, the party I had last year, there was a gentleman here who had seen none of the films. Knew nothing about any of them, really.
And he got all of them.
He won the contest.
Yeah.
Here I am, Mr. Movie Expert. This guy has never entered my house since. I'm just so upset. Our next guest has been waiting patiently on the phone, and we really appreciate it. Our next guest has a wealth of experience in the film industry, having starred in over 24 feature films and appearing in some of our most beloved television shows, like NYPD Blue, Beverly Hills 90210, Veronica Mars, and All My Children. He's also a highly accomplished stand-up comedian and a member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, the Los Angeles Film Teachers Association, and he's the official spokesperson for the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films. If that's not enough, in his new film, Revamped, which enjoyed a national DVD release just yesterday, he is an army of one, producing, writing, directing, and starring in this deliriously fun take on the vampire genre. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jeff Rechter to our program. Jeff, my friend, are you with us?
I'm here.
All right.
I,
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I should make you my new publicist. That was fantastic.
I'm looking for it. I'm open for new opportunities. That sounds great. Tell me a little bit about yourself, how you started in the film industry, how early you knew that this was something that you were passionate about. Who are your inspirations?
Well, I grew up as a kid in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. And I used to take my dad's Super 8 camera and make monster movies in the woods with my friends. And, you know, I never thought about being Spielberg. I never thought about even being an actor. It was just something fun that I enjoyed as a kid. And, of course, I grew up with sci-fi and horror films on Saturday afternoons. And we wound up moving to California. My father was an art director in advertising. And I got a job at Universal Studios as a tour guide. And I was I sneaked down to the sets and watch them film. And one day it just I got overwhelmed by everything, and I said, this is what I want to do.
Mm. Were there artists or filmmakers or films that stood out for you and made you think that's the kind of work that I like to be involved in?
Well, it was the whole magic of, you know, I had done high school plays and all that, and I had fun being an actor, but I never once thought about doing it professionally, but it just hit me that the magic of the whole business and the grips and the cameramen and the makeup people and the actors and everybody working together. It was just this big family working towards this one goal, and it was like, my God, this is what I want to do. I now know I was going to follow in my father's footsteps and get into advertising, and I said, you know what, this is what I'm going to do.
Well, and you've built a career. I mean, just it's staggering. But did you start out as a stand-up comic before you?
Well, actually, I was always an actor. I started doing modeling, and then I worked my way up into commercials, and then TV and film, and. The comedy was just, I also had a background in comedy improvisation.
Right.
And the comedy stand-up was just sort of an offshoot of that where, you know, I like to make my friends laugh and I'm considered to be a funny guy. And so I just started writing stuff down on cocktail napkins and matchbooks. And one day I sort of put it all together and put a routine together and got up and did it.
I cannot think of anything more kind of naked and terrifying than stand-up comedy.
It's tough because the audience will tell you real quick if you're any good.
That's true.
It's not like a band where you've got four other musicians. You're up there on stage alone, and if it hits, it's you, and if you suck, it's you. And so...
Did you find that it? I would think that in terms of, I mean, just on a level of confidence with auditions and things, did you find that kind of came in handy, your stand-up experience?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I couldn't have done it if I hadn't already been an actor and gotten over the stage fright. Mm-hmm. But even then, it's terrifying because it's a whole new thing. It's not like you're reading somebody's lines or doing a script that you know
right.
is good. You're trying out your own material, and you hope that the audience can identify and laugh. About 50% of my stuff got a laugh, and that was good enough for me for the first time. And then you just hone it, and you get rid of the stuff that doesn't work as you go. And pretty soon, you've got a routine that works. But once I'll tell you, anybody that can stand up and get through that can do anything.
Yeah, I would definitely think so. I envy that talent
once
so much.
Once you make that breakthrough.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's nothing
more
fearless than that. So once you get through that, you're golden.
Oh, yeah. Tell me how you got your... I think this was your first gig out of the gate. Was in Oliver Stone's Wall Street?
It was my first feature film where... you know, I was on the big screen. I had you know done a couple of independent films, but that really was my first part in an A feature. And my God, as an actor to be working with Oliver Stone and Michael Douglas and Charlie Sheen and Martin Sheen and and Daryl Hannah. I mean, it was just an all-star cast. It was just an incredible experience.
Tell me,
and once you get that taste, you know, it's like, wow, you know, it's just that'll keep you going for a while.
Tell me about the environment on an Oliver Stone set as you remember it.
Oliver is an incredible, incredibly talented, insightful filmmaker. I think the best word to describe him is he's very intense, and he's very focused. And he knows exactly what he wants, and sometimes, you know, that kind of director can be impatient because he wants to, you know, he wants to get it right off the bat, and sometimes it doesn't work that way. But he knows exactly what he wants, and he puts it up on the screen. And as we can see with Wall Street and the other award-winning films he's done, he's just an incredible director and filmmaker.
He's one of a kind, yeah. But working with Oliver Stone, and you've been in so many dozens of films. Have you learned a lot from the directors that you've worked with, and did that inspire you to start taking on your own material?
Absolutely. I worked with Roger Corman, the king of the independents, and you know, Fred Olen Ray and Jim Wynorski and these guys that made a whole career out of doing, you know, independent, you know, sci-fi horror films, and I learned a lot, and I learned how to make something look much bigger than it was, make it look like a dollar for a nickel, because that's all they had in the budget.
Right.
And also, as an actor, you know, back then we didn't have video. They were shooting film, and you know, especially in those independents, you had one or two takes unless you screwed up a line. You know, you were moving on, so it was almost like it was kind of a running gag where if we didn't like what we were doing, we'd mess up on purpose because it was the only way you'd get another take.
Sure.
You didn't stumble across a line, that was it. You were moving on, but it was great as an actor because you came in there, you were ready to go, and you had to nail it right off the bat because you didn't have the luxury of, you know, of an Oliver Stone film where you can do 30 takes and budget isn't as important. So, and
well,
TV,
you shot
so fast, it worked great for TV because you get in, you nail it, and they love you.
Oh yeah, you shot revamped. Was this a high def?
We did it high def. Yeah, I couldn't have afforded to do it film, quite frankly. But the you know, the mediums have changed and the technology's changed. We shot it high def, and it looks like film. It looks beautiful, and
it really does. And it's offered such. I mean, it's offered
it
so many.
Film.
It really does look
but
beautiful.
You shoot it like a real movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wondering. What does it do to the creative process when you're working? And you spoke to some of it with film versus video, and where you have to mess up a take in order to get another one on film. But with a low budget film, what does the video technology do creatively for you that you can't get with film?
Well, you just said it right there. I mean, you don't have that cost of film. Every time that, you know, the camera turns, it's costing you money. Video, you can do 10 takes. And it's not going to cost you any more,
yeah.
Really. But the downside is it takes time, and time is the one thing you don't have in independent films. You've got to be able to shoot fast. You've got to be able to move fast.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you've got the luxury of more takes for cost wise, you can't eat up the time on the set by doing that. So it's sort of the same time constraint, but certainly not doesn't come out of the pocketbook or the budget.
Right, right. So tell me a little bit about Revamped. What kind of inspired this idea, and what did you want to do with the vampire genre with this film?
Well, actually, it came about from a short film, my first short film I did called Fatal Kiss.
Right.
And it was a half-hour short. It was kind of like a Tales from the Crypt episode. And I wrote, directed, produced, and starred in it and sold it to HBO. It was actually one of the first shorts they had ever bought. And so that was a big kudos for me. It basically, that one short film instantly legitimized me as a writer, director, producer. And because everybody loved it and they said, oh, God, I wish you would have kept going, we actually expanded it and turned it into revamped. So some films that went from feature to short to get the financing to make the feature, we started out as a short with no intention of a feature, but we had such success, and we came up with these great ideas, and we were able to expand it and turn it into a feature film.
What really
did things backwards.
Yeah, but what really fascinates me is how you, I mentioned in the intro that you're an army of one in this thing. You've got all these different hats that you're wearing, writing, directing, producing, casting, starring in it. Are you ever worried that, maintaining the quality of one position sacrifices the quality of the other? I mean, how do you do that?
You know, that's a great question, and people say, you know, how wasn't it tough to write, direct, and do everything at once? It actually streamlined the process because it was easier for me just to do it all than to tell three other people what to do and share that vision of how it needed to happen.
Right.
That actually I was able to work quicker because I didn't have three other people to track down on the set and say, this is what I need next, and I just did it. But, of course, it's four times the work. I didn't say it was easy, but it did work to my advantage, especially when you do have to shoot fast and move along.
Well, you've also assembled a great fun cast in this movie too. Tell us a little bit about who's in the film with you.
Look at the names. It was like it's like the who's who of genre sci-fi and horror, and these are guys that I did an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation when that was on. I did an episode of Sliders when that was on, and so I started doing these sci-fi and horror conventions, signing autographs around the country and even around the world. I just guest starred in one episode of Star Trek, and they flew me to Germany three times. I mean, it was...
Oh, wow.
It's incredible. And so you meet the fans, and you meet these other genre actors. And so I know everybody from Linda Blair to, Freddy Krueger and Kane Hodder, who plays Jason. I got to know all these guys. And so when it came time to make my movie, I just picked up the phone. I said, hey, I'm doing this film. I called in the favors, and everybody said yes. And God bless Marty Cove. You know, he was Cobra Kai Sensei from the Karate Kid movies.
Right.
I'd known Marty for years, and he was the first one that came on board and said yes to play my detective, Rieger. And then, you get one guy, and then I called up Sam Jones, who was Flash Gordon. Sam and I had done a couple of movies already together. And so I got Marty, said, oh, yeah, I'm in. Then it's Sam Jones, and then Fred Williams, and then... You know, everybody starts jumping on the bandwagon, and pretty soon word gets around, and people, call me out of the blue, hey, I heard you're doing this film, you got something for me? And it just was not only to work with these actors, but to be able to direct them, it was just, it just was an incredible experience.
You know, we've had several of the horror sci-fi icons on our show in the past, and it really is a very familial camaraderie that you guys share, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, we've all, we've been fortunate enough to do big budget studio films, and but a lot of us, wind up doing a lot of the independent films as well. And we've all been there. It's like you're in the trenches, and it's not all a great experience. You make of it the best you can, but we all have stories, and it's, as you know, it's a small world, small business in Hollywood, and everybody knows everybody else, and it's actually kind of fun to say, oh, yeah, I heard you worked with so-and-so, and oh, yeah, he's this and he's that, and, you've got the war stories to share, and,
right.
and you have a laugh over it because, If you're in it to make money and be an instant star, forget it. We did it because we loved the business, and we love acting, and we love creating, and that's what everybody has in common. And not always making $1 million, but that's most of the time that's not why you do it. You like the script, you want to work with somebody you haven't worked with before, or your buddy's on it, and it's like, hey, we'll be able to actually hang out and have some fun while we're working.
Yeah, and you feel that. You feel that watching your movie too. I mean, it's great fun, and you feel that everyone out there is just having the time of their lives. You know, just being together and collaborating with one another.
Not everybody shared. But, you know, but everybody that was cool and that, you know, they knew what it was going in. And
right.
And so there was no, you promised me this and, you know, my trailer's bigger than, his trailer's bigger than mine. I mean, those weren't issues on my film.
Right.
But everybody knew what they were getting into and that's that, you know, they did it because they wanted to, not because of the perks.
Yeah, the film is called Revamped.
And we did have a lot of fun.
I bet. The film is called Revamped, and it was released on DVD just yesterday. It's available at all video stores.
Nationwide.
Yeah.
Very excited.
Just off topic before we let you go, are you a fan of the Oscars? Are you looking forward to this Sunday?
I'm going to an Oscar party, baby. Absolutely.
who are your favorites?
Champagne and partying. You better believe it. It's it's the biggest night in Hollywood.
Do you have any favorites this year?
I hate to try and call something and go, you were wrong, but, you know, I have to say No Country for Old Men is terrific. There Will Be Blood is terrific. You know, if I had to say one thing, I have to say that I hope Daniel Day-Lewis wins because
I think it's a sure thing.
I mean, there's so many terrific actors in this town, but he's, to me, coming from an actor, he just is so original, and each one of his characters is so different and so dynamic. If he doesn't get it, it'll be a shame because he completely immerses himself in everything he does. And it literally is not Daniel Day-Lewis up on the screen.
It's amazing. He is a powerhouse.
But Javier Bardem turned in a great performance and a chilling performance. But that's my pick. I mean, any of those nominated, I'd be happy with because
right.
They're all terrific films.
Yeah, it's a great year for movies.
Actors, and it's up to the Academy to really decide, who gets the gold.
I'm looking at some of your future projects. You have one movie on the horizon called Winged Creatures?
Yes.
Well, tell me about that one. This one looks fantastic.
That's very exciting. Kate Beckinsale's new film. It's an all-star cast like mine, but, they're all A-stars. Gene Triplehorn, Dakota Fanning, Guy Pearce.
Wow.
I'm like 10 or 15 below them, but I'll take 15 names below Kate Beckinsale.
Any of us would, absolutely.
I mean, it just, we're very excited about it, and Don't Blink or You'll Miss Me, but... Just to be in a film with that kind of cast is just incredible, and we're expecting big things from it.
Well, that's got to be great, and I urge everyone to all fans of the genre.
A lot of fun for that.
Yeah, I bet all fans of the genre. I urge you to go to your video store and then pick up a copy of Revamped. It's a lot of fun, and Jeff, we really appreciate you coming on our show tonight and spending time with us.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's fun.
Thank you, sir. That's Jeff Rechter. He is the writer, director, producer, star of Revamped, and it's now available on DVD. Pick it up. I think I've read, actually, some dynamite reviews of it. I saw it here a couple of weeks ago, and it's just popping up on the net now. And
yeah,
I've read a lot of
good stuff about it, too.
Yeah, a lot of horror fans are really, really digging it. So it's available for rent and purchase now, so go pick it up. You heard it from the Movie Geeks. And it's been a great Wednesday night show. A lot of good, stimulating conversation.
Yes, it has.
Jerry, do you have anything to say to your countrymen before we log off?
to my countrymen before I log hey, dude, you have to... All right, I'm going to say it because you're not going to say it.
Okay.
But I'm going to say it. Tomorrow night, you're going to be on a show with one of our listeners, Garney, on... What is the gentleman's name?
Jason O'Brien.
Jason O'Brien's Oscar show at 9 o'clock it is?
Yes.
You're on the same time as the debate, I think.
Oh, I've got to tape that debate.
Well, no, just watch it. You can do it like while you're doing the show.
I promise this will be a bloodier debate than what you see on TV.
But no, it's going to be...
You know what they're going to say.
Yeah, but this thing tomorrow night is going to be very bloody.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank God it's only audio and not video.
That's right. I'll be on there. We'll be talking about final Oscar picks. We'll see how much I change my mind between tonight and tomorrow night. And then Jason, the host of that show, which is called Oscar on Blog Talk Radio, and he is the Oscar guru. Actually, he's consumed with Oscar. All year round, his show revolves around Oscar and the different events of the Academy. You know, people tend to think that the Academy only exists once a year, and then they hibernate.
No, that building's open every day. I used to
They have ongoing ongoing events throughout the year, and
they have lots of screenings there. I mean, tons of stuff goes on. So
they're really, really focused on preserving the art of film, and as such, they have a lot of activities year round. But Jason's show focuses on Oscars year round.
He would have been heartbroken if the strike wasn't over.
Yeah,
been really heartbroken, I think.
And he'll be joining us actually next Wednesday with a potential Oscar winner.
That's
you
true.
Think Peter and the Wolf, keep your fingers crossed, listeners, because we might have an Oscar winner next week.
you're gonna really milk this.
Am I helping them or am I cursing them?
I don't know, but I hope they win it just so, because if you don't, hey, man, we listen to the show, man, you jinxed us.
I know, I don't want to do that, but, you know, I have such respect for it, and I watched the movie, too. They sent it over, and it's astounding. I mean, it was like a computer, I think it's done on the computer animation, but the look of it is, I don't know what makes it look so different. I'm so not schooled on that art,
mm-hmm.
but it's a... such a gorgeous movie to look at. Just the visuals are just so expressive. And it's a classic story, very well told, and it's a great little film. And we're rooting for it, man. We're rooting for that, Marco Beltrami.
There you go, baby.
All right.
All right.
Movie Geeks United signing off. Join us Oscar night. We will be there red carpet will be going on while we're on.
It will be going on. You know, that will be our final Oscar picks. I'm not doing any sort of Oscar thing this year, but that will be the closest I come to any sort of Oscar
picks. Yeah, and we've done our Oscar picks. I mean, we spent an hour and a half on them, Sunday's show should be an opportunity for all of our listeners to call in with their Oscar picks, and then we're going to have some fun. We're probably going to talk about the dresses on the red carpet for a little while, and maybe Chris and I will do a scene from an Oscar-nominated movie. Maybe, Jerry, you can come in on that, too.
I'll just belch when you guys do that, maybe.
Just practice your acting chops, dude. I'll give you a scene, and that'll be hysterical if we all can do that. Anyway,
all right.
We will see everyone back here on Sunday
night.
Oh,
Anthony T. does not like that idea. Okay.
Who doesn't like it?
He said no, and I don't know whether he's making fun of Darth Vader and Revenge of the Sith or not, but okay. This is long no in the chat room. It's like my dad. No. All right, let's call it a night.
All right, I think that's it. I think we're done.
Okay.
Thank you so much, everyone out there, for joining us tonight. We'll see you back here Sunday night, Oscar night. Bye bye now.
All right. Bye bye.